Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Raskin, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience here at Amherst, and I have the honor of speaking today with Dr. David Kessler. I've known David for many years. I had the privilege of being in the administration when David, you were on the Board of Trustees from 1999 to 2011, is that right?
Two terms, 12 years.
Wow. That's great. Well, we overlapped for, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 of those years, and I remember spending a lot of time talking to you on the instruction committee, and it was terrific.
Same here.
Thank you. Thank you for so much for participating in Amherst Reads. Most people don't really need an introduction to you, but if you don't mind, I'm just going to give a very brief synopsis of what I would say to our alums is one of our very extraordinary accomplished alums. So Dr. Kessler is professor of pediatrics and epidemiology and biostatistics at the School of Medicine, UC San Francisco. He was the dean of the School of Medicine and vice chancellor for medical affairs at UCSF from 2003 to 2007, the dean of Yale School of Medicine from 1997 to 2003. We all know that you, David, served as the commissioner for the United States Food and Drug Administration from November 1990 to March 97. So, in other words, David Kessler is a hero. That's why I want to make that clear. As commissioner of the FDA, you were enormously successful. You acted to speed approval of new drugs and promising therapies. And some people, and under your direction, you announced new programs regulating marketing and the sale of tobacco for children and new nutritional labeling for food. A lot of people say that single-handedly changed the tobacco industry. According to the New York Times, you revitalized a beleaguered agency that had become mired in bureaucratic disarray. You have a range of experience in research, clinical medicine, education, administration. You graduated from Amherst in 1973, but I don't actually know what your major was. Were you biology, psychology?
You know, it was a time when we didn't have majors. We were allowed to be, remember this independent scholar?
Oh, you're an independent scholar. Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, later on I want to ask you some questions about that Amherst. Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Amherst, you received your law degree from the University of Chicago in 1978, where you were a member of Law Review, and your MD from Harvard Medical School in 79. Your internship and residency in pediatrics was at Johns Hopkins. You're the author of numerous research papers, including now 3 important books. The End of Overeating, I read twice. I loved it. Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. It was an instant New York Times bestseller. And before that, A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry. That was a triumph. You're the recipient of so many awards that I couldn't even begin to list them, but I will list a few. American Cancer Society Medal of Honor, American Academy of Pediatrics Excellence in Public Service Award, and my favorite is the 2008 National Hero Award from the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. So with that introduction, it's just wonderful to have you to talk to, and we're going to be talking today about your newest book, Capture, Unraveling the Mystery of Mental Suffering. I so enjoyed reading your book, just as I enjoyed the previous two. It's absolutely beautifully written and extremely absorbing, and I love the way you pull together literature and neuroscience and psychology and philosophy. It's just remarkable. So I just thought I would begin by asking you to explain to others the concept of capture for those who haven't yet read the book and who don't have a background in any of those fields I just mentioned.
You know, the hypothesis is that there is a common mechanism that underlies many of our emotional struggles and mental illnesses. And that in itself, I understand, is a pretty, bold statement. But, simply put, a stimulus. It could be a place, a thought, a memory, an object, a person. Something takes hold of our attention, and there's a shift in our perception. You know, but the theory of capture, you know, really is composed of three elements. There's a narrowing of attention. Something seizes our attention. There's a connection. There's a change in affect. So it's not that I just attend to something different, but it makes me feel differently. And there can be, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be, there can be a perceived lack of control. Now, we may sense a mental shift, but we don't necessarily understand where it comes from when it happens. So the experience occurs outside our conscious control, and we sort of surrender to it before we even perceive that it's going on.
I was going to ask you something about how much you thought, how much of it you thought was conscious and how much unconscious. Not unconscious in the Freudian sense, but unconscious in the sense of out of awareness.
I think it starts out of awareness. Mm-hmm. I think there's an automaticity to the process. Now, of course, you know, why do I attend to certain things? I mean, there can be, you know, at the simplest level, right? Something becomes salient. What do I mean by that? Something becomes important. Something has meaning. You know, it could be, you know, I mean, just the brightness, a color, a shape, emotion, novelty can all give an object salience. So if I'm a bird and I'm flying overhead and I'm, in order to be able to detect food, you know, motion becomes very salient. Something that is, you know, all of a sudden coming at me, something that looks very different. There's a physical aspect to that salience, but there's also salience in powerful desires or immediate or distant goals, attitudes, major life events. So anything that can have meaning for me can become salient.
So salience means something very important to both of us, but to people who don't know what that means, would you say it's like it's something particularly grabbing or something particularly important?
Right. And how does something become particularly important?
Right.
I mean, so obviously, you know, a bright light, right. And there may be a biological mechanism, or if something differentiates a color, but you know The salience of a stimulus is heavily influenced by how, in essence, it relates to what's important to me, what's my personal experience. So past learning and past memories, I mean, what do I remember? What do any of us really remember? We remember what's salient, something that sticks out, and something that's out of the ordinary, and especially what has meaning for me. Because what's salient for me may be very different than what's salient for you.
Right.
So past learning, past experience, past memories shape what I'm going to attend to. And I think that if you understand sort of the neural wiring, I mean, we're still learning, you know, how it actually works. I mean, because we're really talking about the emotional core, I mean, of our brains. But I think there's an automaticity based on that past learning and past memory. I'm very good, you know, whether it's learning exactly what the circuits are, whether they're motivational circuits. I can attend out of all the stimuli that are bombarding me. So I can only focus on certain things. We can only attend to certain stimuli. We can't attend to the thousands of things that are in our environment every second. So I'm going to be able to pick out, attend to certain things that are important to me because of past learning and past memory. And I think I cue into those stimuli. I think there's an automaticity.
Yeah.
And I think that's how the process begins.
Right.
So sorry.
No, I was just thinking that there's a conscious awareness of stimuli, and then there's an unconscious awareness of stimuli, and then there are those stimuli that don't even get processed. But, you know, so many stimuli, I think, do get processed unconsciously because they are meaningful to the subject. You know, and because we are bombarded with so much stimuli, and yet some of it does fall to the periphery. Some of it we know we're looking at in other things. I mean, there's so many studies now that show people are looking at something and they don't see it, and yet they recognize it later. They say they don't see it, and then they recognize it later. You know,
and there's a moment where that cue, where my attention is grabbed. And it will, you know, it could be just a second or even less, you know, a millisecond, where it does come into conscious control. But something grabs me. So, I mean, and I think that is one of the key aspects of attention, that things are grabbing us because they have meaning, because of past experience. At least that's the hypothesis. But again, it's not, I don't think capture is just the grabbing of attention. I mean,
right.
Because then, you know, why would it really affect us? I mean, we could then move our attention.
Right.
But I think that, you know, it was, you know, remember we all learned, right, about a reinforcer,
right?
And what's a reinforcer?
Right.
And really, we all learned, you know, the rats press the lever for a reward. But, you know, this was, and you know him very well, you know, the great Jerome Kagan,
sure.
The developmental psychologist at Harvard, I mean, I think studied with, right?
Rose studied with him.
Rose studied with him.
Yeah, I was at Princeton. But I did what is called developmental psychobiology, which is basically the development of the brain and behavior. And so, my next question is going to be how early this starts.
What Kagan told me, right, was that what really makes a reinforcer is something that can change how I feel. That moment really still sticks with me,
right.
Because you know we always thought, you know, the rat will press a lever. You know, I mean, for sweetness. Well, you know, the sweetness can have an affective component, right? It can make me feel better.
And
so,
exactly.
Right? So things, you know, can make me either, that I will attend to, are things that I think will either make me feel better or feel worse, right? I will remember those things. Those things are memorable. Right, are things that can have an effect on how I feel, both positively and negatively.
Right. I think I would almost say that the elements that you've talked about, first is the narrowing of attention, second would be the change in the emotional state, and then third would be the perceived, you know, then eventually a perceived lack of control. Like, I can't resist. I can't, you hear people, and you wrote about this in your second book, I can't resist that sugar. Or I can't resist that nicotine, or I can't resist that. And so there's the lack of control, which comes after the narrowing of attention and the change in the emotional state.
My hand goes and reaches for that chocolate chip cookie before
right.
I even think, do I want that chocolate chip cookie?
That's right. I'm just going to say something that I heard this, and you probably have heard it too, and you'll love it, which is between the stimulus and the response is freedom. Isn't that great?
So, you know, that's key. Right?
Yeah.
Because we're talking about, right, these are different areas of the brain.
Right.
So it's not that I really lose control. I'm conscious. I can change what I want to do. But there are circuits. There's these automatic circuits.
Right.
But there's always a moment, I think, I mean, if I'm right, where, you know, the more rational, the higher cortical levels, the higher cortical circuits allow me, right, to at least possibly change course. So, I mean, I'm stimulated, I'm aroused, I feel a certain way. I've not yet acted. My hand's not reached. I've not done anything. Right? But can I alter that stimulus response? But, you know, the question is, some stimuli become so strong and so powerful, and those circuits become, you know, in essence, you know, the more we engage in that experience, the more learning that occurs, those circuits become, you know, it is Hebb's rule, right? I mean, those things that constantly are fired, wired together, and we are, and so that there may be, in certain instances, very strong stimuli, right, after, you know, repeated experiences, where that opportunity for freedom, at least, you know, probably, you know, we sense, you know, very little opening. But that's the hope in this, right?
Right. I actually recently started teaching Introduction to Psychology, which I never taught. I always taught, you know, the bio psych part of it, but now I teach the broad class, and I begin by asking my students who in the class thinks that there is, that he or she has free will. And I don't mean free will independent of a God, but I mean free will, that all the decisions you're making are decisions that you are making because you've thought about it. And you know, some kids actually say that they do, and I say, forget it. By the time they are their age, they have had so much experience. That isn't to say, you know, there isn't any, but maybe 80-20 or something. But by the time they get to their young adulthood, they have not only have their behavior has been reinforced in a certain way, their neurons have been connected, have been, you know, enjoined in a certain way, and if you think about how long it takes for an aplegia to learn one reflex, right, or one response, just multiply that by a billion, and that's just so changing human behavior, it would seem, would be pretty difficult, don't you think?
You may want to tell our listeners about aplegia.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Well, they're snails, and the Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel was the first person to publish articles showing how neurons change in response to a stimulus and a response, and he used reinforcement. He used those snails because they have a finite number of neurons that can be identified and actually recorded from. So. That's how we know that was the beginning of the neural basis of learning and memory, which is what we're really talking about, of shaping behavior.
It's learning. It's certainly the learning circuits. Right? It's certainly the memory circuits.
Right.
And there's probably certain motivational circuits. You know, whether, you know, for the neuroscientists who may be listening, you know, are we talking about D2 receptors or D3 receptors?
Right.
And what the inhibitory effects on those dopamine neurons. But I think also, you know, probably they just gate attention, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they certainly help reinforce what becomes salient to me.
And the amygdala, which is a part of the limbic system that people would say is kind of part of the animal brain and mediates aggression and even attachment, learns. It's a structure that changes with experience.
So you just said something very significant, because you talked about both aggression, right?
Yeah.
Fear,
right?
I mean, and then also you talked about the counter, right? I mean, you said was it learning?
Mostly fear, but certain limbic areas, the hypothalamus, they do respond to attachment.
Well, attachment, that's right. So, but attachment could be positive, right?
So we used to think
of the amygdala as only the negative sort of experiences,
right?
The things that are salient, that are negatively valent, the things that give me fear. But what we learned, and this was sort of grew out of our work on eating, was the people who have this conditioned hypereating, I mean, who are constantly reacting to food, they have excessive activation of the amygdala, both when they're cued and as they're eating. So it's not just, the salient things cannot just be negative, but they can be positive.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's how we grow up and have attachments to our significant other, you know, family members, mothers, fathers. I mean, that bonding happens immediately and is crucial.
So is capture, if you know, again, the focus of the book, you know, was on both the negative, the things that cause us stress, cause us distress, but also can be the positive things. I mean, if it's attachment, you know, what about love?
Right.
What is that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, how does that capture my, how does love, you know, capture my attention? It makes me feel a certain way. You know, one of the hard parts, you know, that I encountered was the idea of capture came out. It started with nicotine because I had to learn everything about addiction.
Right.
And what is addiction?
Right.
Right. I mean, it's cue-induced wanting. Right. But they're, you know, based on past learning or past experience, whether it's a drug or a food, a certain behavior I engage in, and it can affect how I feel. And the next time I get exposed to that same cue of that drug or that food, I arouse those same circuitry, and then I get caught in this cycle. So everything really grew out. You know, it started with nicotine. You know, why does that cigarette? Why do I, you know, pick up that one and then 780,000 more for the rest of my life,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And why does that nicotine have such power over me? Why does that chocolate chip cookie? So I went to food. And then the question is, in doing the book, you know, I wanted to explore this concept of capture, you know, this seizing of our attention, this changing how we feel. But, you know, what were the limits? You know, so the book started out.
Uh-huh.
Right. I mean, I wanted to explore. I mean, the thing that was most important to me was to try to show how we're all vulnerable to capture.
Good. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the first. This is not something. It's not that we're broken. This is the way we're wired.
Right.
And you know, the book. I mean, after I did the eating book and sort of focusing on this concept. You know, I became very interested, as you know, in one of our fellow colleagues, you know, David Foster Wallace.
Yes, I was going to ask you, yeah.
And his depression, because he wrote about his depression. And,
right.
And he didn't understand the neural circuitry.
Right. You didn't know him, right? Or did you know him?
I did not know him. Uh-huh. He was about a decade after me.
Uh-huh.
But I got to know his parents well. I got to know his sister well, and I got to know many of his classmates very well. Because you see, depression with a capital D, sort of starting, you know, in late adolescence. But certainly, he left Amherst, you know, twice. So I became very interested in whether depression involves this sort of continual focus on negative thoughts and experience and memories to the feeling and exclusion of all else, and how someone who's depressed, you know, really gets captured by these negative thoughts and experiences and narrows his or her attention, you know, focusing, you know, you talk about David, focusing on only the most negative stimuli.
Right.
And then what he did in his writings was he really explained this sort of feedback cycle, right? Because I focus on the negative, that makes me feel sad, it makes me feel bad, and then I end up focusing on what makes me feel sad and what makes me feel bad.
You have the thought that's negative, and that creates the emotion, and then you live in the emotion, and so you think it's real.
Not only do I live in that emotion then captures that sadness. Captures my attention. I'm broken. I'm a failure.
That's right.
I feel I'm never going to feel better. So there is how that output of that cycle then becomes the input for the next round and how it's self-sustaining.
Exactly. So, exactly. Yep. Yep.
So I was very interested in depression. It could capture be a basis of depression, right? And then anxiety, what
right.
captures us in anxiety,
right.
going over a bridge or getting near a ledge or fear of being a fraud,
right.
Expectation that something is going to be bad. So certain things are going to capture me. Then I became very interested in the eating disorders,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, the fear of getting fat.
Yeah.
If I take an apple and I slice it in 80, 80 pieces, and I can exert such control over myself. So is it the fear of getting fat that captures me, or is it the control and how I can just feel good about myself, right? Because I can exert this amount of control. I'm in control. In trauma, the harm that was done to us, the being abandoned,
right.
Takes precedence. Hypochondria, what's hypochondriasis?
Right.
I have a
narrowing your focus on one particular, mole on your face or something.
Absolutely. I mean, so you see this in a range of affective conditions.
Right.
And then the question became, is it possible that this mechanism, or these circuits are involved in a range of disorders?
Yeah. I love what you're saying, that it's a hypothesis, that it's an underlying basis for many, 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 much mental suffering that we see, if not all. I mean, that it's your one hypothesis of bringing everything together, and not only in negative situations, but also in exalted situations, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So the positive, aspect. There's the positive access, but there is still, if you look, if the self, I mean, for David Wallace,
right.
the focus on the self, I'm a fraud, I'm no good, I'm really just, yes, I can write well, but I really am fooling people,
yeah.
right? And you see this being captured, when it really focuses, the one thing you can't get rid of, you're always with is yourself, right? I mean, so
better
that,
or worse. Right.
And so you have that pain. That, I mean, certain things we can just walk away from. That chocolate chip cookie I can walk away from, right? The nicotine or tobacco I can walk away from, but myself.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
That's.
I mean, I'm always there, but so I can focus on myself internally, but I can also, I think, end up focusing very much on external stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
You slighted me. You made me feel bad. And
right.
I think that
right.
I can be captured, by an abiding sense of rage.
Yes. So it's an addiction. It's an addiction almost to your own feelings, to your feelings of feeling bad.
And it's focused. I think if you look at, if you look at psychopathy or psychopathic behavior.
Right.
I mean, when it was always viewed as a lack of conscience, an absence of anxiety or guilt, and a failure of empathy.
Right.
But those focus on only what's absent in the mind of the psychopath.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, but I think if you really, and I spend time, you look at the journals, because you have to be very, what data can you look at and what's
right.
reliable. So the book really focused on people's own writings, on their own words,
yes.
what they said,
yes.
right? Not my interpretation
right.
of that. But if you look at any of the mass shooters, I mean, they all, felt very bad
very angry.
About something that made them just enormously angry. And, so one of the concerns was, is this too broad? Right? But there really are, I think there are neural circuits that underlie this, this mechanism. And,
right.
and I think that the mechanism is neutral, right? The mechanism is, it can be, I can get attached to things, as you said, that are positive or attached to things that are negative. It can go either way. But the fact is, I think we're all going to get attached to certain things. So what captures me
right.
can, I think, end up with many different kinds of outcomes.
Yes, yes. No, I think that's fantastic. It really is. It's a fantastic hypothesis, and you made your argument so well throughout the whole book, and you know, spiritual capture and violent capture and capture and depression. I use the Darkness Visible in one of my courses, Styron's book. William Styron has been in and out of depression his whole adult life, and I remember, and you referenced the moment when he, he's a heavy drinker, and then he gives up alcohol, but he had made a decision to commit suicide, and he happened to be listening to the Brahms Alto Rhapsody, and then his feelings for his mother made him so, just stopped him, and they were so strong that he decided to commit himself to save himself. And that's a really interesting example of capture kind of going both ways. You know, he's completely overwhelmed by his sadness and his feeling, his lack of self-esteem and his feelings of, self-worthlessness. And then he's reminded of his mother and it's changed, and it's like instantly changed.
Between, as you said, between stimulus and response,
yeah, that was
there's
a,
that
yeah.
moment,
yeah.
you know, of freedom. But, you know, what is that? I mean, my sense is, you know, in that really is the hope. I mean, is there freedom from capture? And mm-hmm. you know, if you look at that moment, Ruth Styron, his widow, was very kind and talked to me.
Rose.
You know,
Rose
Styron, sorry. Rose Styron, you know, was very kind and talked to me. And
that's great. She must be such an interesting person.
Oh, she's, you know, just enormously kind.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's interesting is in that moment, where is their freedom? And I mm-hmm. think if you look, there was, you know, as bad as he felt about himself, that he wasn't going to be able to write again, that he had not written, you know, the great book in several decades, regardless of, you know, his enormous productivity, you see something else that was even more meaningful capture him. Right,
yeah.
that Brahms, listening to the Brahms, his mother, that had its own evocative appeal.
Right.
You know, so I think that the most important secret about capture, I mean, if I could say that, is, you know, one of the most effective ways to be released from being captured is to find something else that is more meaningful. You know, the replacing one form of negative capture with a positive form.
Right, right.
Right.
Well, that's how you end the book, by saying, you know, the involvement in other people and the involvement in the community or the involvement in art or in some getting outside yourself is. I mean, I think about people who have generalized anxiety disorder, and one of their worst symptoms is that they worry about being anxious. They're anxious about being anxious. Which means that they're just completely self-involved, you know, that why are you worried about going outside? Because I'm afraid I'll be anxious. And if they could lose themselves in something else, in the flow of life or love, then they would be released, which is how you are ending your book with the antidote to the negative capture.
You know, I think that's probably, can I just distance myself? Can I just quiet the stimulus? Right? Can I just go from something that's negatively valent to neutral? Or do I really have to replace it with something that's positive? And I don't know the answer to that. My guess is,
mm-hmm.
if you look at Eastern thought, right? And if you look
right.
at Buddhism, and I mean, is that just quieting the stimulus, or am I substituting, or even quieting the stimulus has a positive valence to it?
Sure, I would think that. And I was going to ask you how you thought this related to mindfulness, the Jon Kabat-Zinn work, because it does. It seems to me, I mean, and I've been studying mindfulness myself and doing it, and the discipline that you have in meditating and you activate these areas, the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex, that would be able to inhibit negative associations in the amygdala. The discipline of just focusing on the here and now allows you to have some pause in between that stimulus and the response that you would ordinarily make, which might be self-destructive.
You know, I think a lot of people use mindfulness, right, in many different ways.
Right.
You know, and that's why, I mean, he was very nice, Jon Kabat-Zinn, to talk to me in the book.
Yeah.
Is mindfulness, you know, some people think it's being captured by certain stimuli in itself. I'm being mindful. I'm attending,
mm-hmm.
right? Or is it really letting go? Right?
Yes, right. Yes. I think it has to be both.
I think letting go is
really important.
Right. I mean, where you take the you don't allow that affective component to exist. I think it is one approach. I think if you look, probably. For many people, the change, you know, you look at AA, what is AA?
Right.
What really gets substituted for those who are successful? And this data is still out, I think, right? I mean, I think there's a sense that it works. There are some trials that Alcoholics Anonymous works. But what are you really, are you substituting that fellowship? Are you substituting that sobriety?
Right.
Something takes the place of that's more important, right? It just is, William Styron, that moment when he heard that music, that sense that, I can be free of drink, that I can help someone else. There's something more important. I think there are a lot of different approaches, you know, whether it's AA, whether it's spiritual, whether it's psychotherapy. I mean, what's psychotherapy?
Yeah, that's exactly,
Right, I mean, how do I change how I look at a stimulus, right? What's cognitive behavioral therapy? Or the one thing that I have not been able to figure out at all, that I don't touch in the book, that I just, it's sort of counterintuitive, you know, I just couldn't sort it out, is attention deficit. And what is that?
Is that
something where I'm captured constantly by different things?
Well, could be. Yeah. Or either you're, I mean, those children or even adults are highly distractible. So they're just captured either by too much, or they lack the focus to be captured by the positive. Interestingly, children with ADHD, they love television, they love computers, so if there's a highly salient stimulus, they'll be sucked in.
It's not that they lack attention, right? It's just that what they attend to may not be what we as a society at that moment, or their school teacher, or what their environment calls for.
Right, that's right.
Right.
Because they can't sustain it, and that's not acceptable, certainly not in public schools.
Right. I mean, but I do think there are certain things that they attend to, you know, very strongly. I mean, I think it's also true in Asperger's.
I was just thinking of that. Yeah, kids who get fixated on machines, washing machines, or trains or something, and they know everything in every detail, and it's a real overfocus.
Right. I mean, exactly. So where is this overfocus, or is it an underfocus, right? I can't connect with you, I can't look you in the eye. Is that a fear? I mean, are they just hypersensitive to certain stimuli that either can make them feel better or feel worse?
Right. Well, I think the jury's out on that, but it certainly could be, the hypothesis could be used that capture is important in these disorders that we've just mentioned.
Yeah, and then what's the implications for psychiatry.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, I mean, really, in terms of like mental health being such a public health issue, and it seems like it's not getting better. How do you see a way that you could describe what goes on in CAPTCHA to people in that helping profession?
But you know, people always go, all right, it's very nice explaining how my neural circuitry is working, but now tell me how I fix it.
Exactly.
Right? And that's the hard part. And
right.
If you say, look, you have to be captured by something that's more important, it's easier said than done.
Absolutely.
Right.
Right.
But there's almost a sense, right? I mean, that if you could change, especially, I've seen both on, the sides. If you look at David Foster Wallace when he was an adolescent, when he was at Amherst, right? I mean, that student, right? I mean, and who is having these bad thoughts, right? Who and those bad thoughts isolate them. They can't talk about it because they're embarrassed.
Right.
And then they go, why am I having these bad thoughts? And then I must be bad. But I can't share what's going on in my head because people will, think worse of me. And then they sort of end up becoming more and more isolated.
Right.
If you can get to them at an early stage and be able to explain to them that they're not bad, that we all get captured by certain things.
And we all have these thoughts,
And we all have these thoughts.
It's a matter of degree,
Right. The question is, how can you, I think if we can just explain that and get to people, especially young people, at the right time.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, can we alleviate at least the pain that accompanies and the isolation? Because, my sense is, once these bad thoughts, take over, once this isolation, this getting further and further into my head, becoming socially isolated, and then going in, my sense is, medicine can quiet down these circuits, certainly, right?
Right.
But
right.
They also have side effects. And sometimes these side effects can become salient.
Yeah.
And then it's very hard to sort out what's from the medicine and what's from, underlying it.
And the medicine can attenuate the bad feelings, but then there's somebody with social phobia has to then learn how to live in life, and without some re-education, that wouldn't happen just with medication. I mean, the studies show that the medication and therapy is the best way to handle, to the extent that we can see any improvement in mental health clients and psychiatric clients.
But, my sense is that much of, the antidepressants sort of quiet the circuitry, right? And then psychotherapy allows me to sort of change the context, right, to find something else so that I can be captured by something else, or at least understand how to manage the negative.
See, I think that's the important thing. If you can turn down the noise in your mind and quiet those thoughts, and then you can understand what it is that you're saying to yourself, which is what you were talking about with David Foster Wallace, and what you're telling, it sounds very cognitive behavioral therapy, but telling what are the voices in your head, what are you saying to yourself about yourself, you can understand that you can change those thoughts.
Absolutely. So here's a question for you. Being able to understand how our minds work, isn't that a key part of a liberal arts education?
Oh, I love you're saying that. Absolutely. In all disciplines, that's absolutely what. And also challenging what we think. And the way we think about it, and being brave enough, courageous enough to challenge assumptions that we've always had. I think that is, to me, central to a liberal arts education and to an Amherst education, which you had.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I will admit you asked me what my major was, and I spent almost all my time, you know, I mean, in the sciences, certainly my junior and senior year. But in doing this book, what I found was, you know, sure, the sciences are absolutely essential, I mean, to understand the neural circuitry, to know how neurons respond. And any theory, any hypothesis has to be grounded in those, that neurobiology. But in fact, I mean, it was other disciplines.
Yeah.
Sort of the privilege of going back and understanding how, certainly, you know, how great writers. I mean, one of the great things was to be able to try to see whether this mechanism exists, because no fMRI, no magnetic resonance imaging, no experiment on a snail is going to allow me to understand that the subjective feelings that are associated with capture. And yet you go and you see, you know, one of the great privileges in what the book, you know, focus on, you know, on a number of great writers who are able to explain much better than I could ever explain what they're feeling and what's going on.
And your descriptions of them are just brilliant. I mean, it's really, really, talking about capture, I mean, it's really, it's so engrossing to the way you write about, the way you write about Virginia Woolf. And I love the fact that you went back to your, you went to Robert Doran, Susan Neidich, and George Catip.
So in theology, you know, in the theological tradition, there has to be a form, at least my sense was, there was a form of capture, right? I mean,
absolutely,
as a basis for theological and spiritual experience. But so what I was very interested in was, I mean, did the theological, thought leaders, I mean, did the great theologians over centuries, did they understand this, or were they just living this?
Oh, yes, right, right.
I mean, or when you're in it, it's happening to you.
Right,
right.
Right.
And then if you look, what I was very interested, you know, obviously, you can, I mean, it has some relevance, not to get political, right? But, you know, what captures us in, you know, in this political cycle?
That's exactly, I was thinking that very thing, and I didn't know whether I could ask that.
So that's when I went to Professor Catap.
Yes, right.
To try to
right.
understand.
Yeah, the ideological half-thinking that you mentioned he talked about.
What does that mean? I mean, I'm captured by certain ideas that have resonance, even though, because they have meaning for me and they affect how I feel, right? And they become part of me. I mean, is that, does this circuitry also respond, right? And so when you look, I mean, it's probably the great philosophers. I mean, Plato came pretty close when he looked at the disparate parts of the mind. You know, Socrates, I mean, do I do things that I wish, you know, that are not in my own interest? So they grapple with them.
Right.
So if you look at philosophy and theology and political science and sociology and psychology, I mean, it was sort of, you need the learnings across disciplines.
Right. That's absolutely right.
I mean, because the question is, you know, as David Wallace said, you know, what is it, you know, what does it take to make us human?
Right, right. And to, as you say, understand subjective experience and, you know, religious conversion and the passion that people experience.
I mean, the implications of it, right? I mean, if in fact there is a common mechanism, right? Let's assume that, you know, we're half right. Okay, we'll learn more about the neural circuitry as the years go on, and others will understand attention and affective experience. But if these fields are really connected, the implications for those who I think suffer the most is, I mean, is to show that they are not broken.
That they that this is our natural tendency to be kept.
Right.
Yeah,
are there differences? Are some of us more susceptible?
That's
are some
right.
of us less susceptible?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it used to be, you know, depression, this was, you know, these were, our neurotransmitter system was broken.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and you know, also now with epigenetics, the idea that, so many studies looking at the genetics of depression and other correlations and families and schizophrenia and so on. But then the idea that now that the environment can turn genes on and off and is really about the, I guess, the capture from the environment of what your natural predilection is.
And it's so hard to know, right? My sense is that, I mean, if we're turning, we're such effective learners as a species.
Yes.
If we really could measure every experience, every attentional moment, every affective response to that attentional moment over a lifetime.
Right.
I mean, obviously that's not to be, but if you could measure that, you could probably then explain why certain things capture me and not you, right? Because what I've attended to over a lifetime. But no doubt, we are all sort of, even if this is a common mechanism,
mm-hmm.
there are, you know, we're all sort of, there are different thresholds. Why do I respond, you know, more affectively to certain experiences and you may not. I mean, is there a genetic basis? Why am I more outgoing, right?
Yeah.
Why am I more inwardly going? Maybe there is something. I mean, it's not that there's a gene that tells me what I'm going to be captured by. I don't think there's a gene, right, to say whether I'm going to be depressed.
Right.
But you would
see that, and again, studies show you would see that in babies. You know, you can even see the difference in infants' response to stimuli that might kind of set them on a course that would they'll be captured by one thing or another going forward, and depending on how they respond to the stimuli and how the world responds to them, it'll be shaped one way or another. But it's probably both the learning and also the inherent differences in sensory perception when you're an infant.
And going back to the question about a liberal arts education, I think for many of us, we enter Amherst with, you know, being captured by certain ideas,
yeah.
And thoughts, and the question is, does the Amherst experience, I mean, can it teach me how to be free of some of the, whether they're biases or negative things that or broader experiences that I can experience, so that in essence, when I leave, I'm captured by different things than when I enter.
Right. Well, this is fascinating. You're so brilliant, David. So interesting. The
question is, the real question, okay,
yeah.
is, you know, what did we get right?
Right. Right.
That's the question. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, people read the book and they say, you know, they like the story. Some get the book, some don't get the book, et cetera. Because, you know, in sort of the Amherst tradition, the goal was to show it, not to lecture about it, right? So it was to show these various experiences.
That's right,
But you make the reader work. But the question is, that's still the unknown, even, you know, the book's been out a couple of months, is, I mean, did we get this right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly make us the strong argument for the thread, for connecting the dots and for keeping the making the thread across all of these experiences and disciplines.
But it can't be, Lisa, Professor Eskin, it can't be this simple, can it? I mean, in some ways, Is this really underlying mental illness? I mean, can it be?
I think as you talk about it, if you know, you're not saying that it does. You're saying it's a theory that encapsulates all aspects of it, and that you talk about the history of the individual, the individual differences in the brain early on, and so that's all part of it. You're not saying that you're not saying this that there explains everything, but that there's a theory that holds it together.
But does that theory even, is there validity in that theory? Right? When you live it, when you write it,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, I see it. But,
right.
you know, there's no way I can empirically prove it. I mean,
that's
you can't take,
saying,
right? I mean, you can't take Virginia Woolf and David Foster Wallace and scan them and look exactly what neural circuits, right? That's not possible, right?
Yeah.
So the goal is over the next decade that, you know, people will, you know, take the theory and try to understand attention and what grabs attention and affective response and try to map those circuits.
Right. The comforting thing that you're saying, I think, is that we all have these circuits, that to have these circuits is not to be broken, but rather to be our species. And we will all get captured by one thing or one stimulus or another, depending on our history. But that we could understand it that way, it's self-forgiving in a way, you know, and people who do get obsessed with the cookie or obsessed with the cigarette or obsessed with the bad thoughts about themselves, it then tend to make it worse by beating themselves up about that. But to say, you know, this is who we are because of our neural circuits. Our neural circuits will tend to do this, and you will get captured one way or another. So go easy on yourself and try to understand it that way. I think that's very comforting.